Okay, we'll bring the order, bring the meeting to order, Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Drossel. Representative Howell.
Present.
Representative Romer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward. Representative Thurless.
Present.
Okay, we've got a quorum. We've need a motion to approve the minutes for February 14th.
So moved.
Representative Pinto moves the minutes for February 14th, Valentine's Day. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Members, we're going to switch the order, and we're going to start out with House File 346. What I'll do is, how this will work, hopefully, is I'll make a short introduction of House File 346. Then I'll turn it over to the presenters, two or three of them. And after they're done presenting, if we want to wait with the financial mechanism questions, I'm going to have our fiscal analyst, John Walsh, follow up with the presenters. But we can naturally go ahead and ask questions of the presenters. But I just wanted to let you know that Mr. Walsh was going to follow up with the fiscal note, which I think we just received the new completed fiscal note today. So, and as always, we'll keep hold of the bill or drag it back in if things change on the fiscal. So, all right, members, I would move House File 346 to be recommended to go to Ways and Means. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was the bill I had actually hoped that we could do, have a quick presentation on cultural competency, and I would still like to push that idea forward. So when I talked to you about, I didn't realize this was going to be up today so quickly. Is that something we can talk about after the meeting, maybe?
We can incorporate it in with the you're talking about a special one?
Like a 15-minute presentation as to what it is. I think that there is some learning curve as far as that goes that a lot of us could use a refresher as to exactly what it is and how it works. And I notice that in your bill it talks about cultural diversity. This would be to why it's important.
Okay, not today, though, you mean?
Not today, no. The college professor is in Mankato.
Sounds good.
Okay, thank you. We'll talk afterwards. All right, thanks.
Okay, like to move amendment in your packet, author's amendment, the A2 amendment. The chair would move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the A2 is to delete a couple of sections related to data, but that there may be an opportunity to see those provisions again. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Yes. The A2 amendment will remove the sections on data collection, so this can go straight to Ways and Means, and we'll maybe follow that up, talk about the possibility of that anyway, with a separate bill with those provisions, and then sending that to a civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the chair has moved A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill in the proper form. Members, House File 346 is going to change both the funding mechanism for training for peace officers and some of the make recommendation for policy as well as add money to the training. We did this to address the concerns of many of the advocacy groups that have been talking to us for the last couple of years and law enforcement. This is going to expand the type of training courses required for peace officers to renew their license every 3 years, to include in continuing education credits in crisis intervention, mental illness, conflict management, mediation, and recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences. It increases the state reimbursement for local agencies training from approximately $300 to $1,000 per officer annually to ensure peace officers meet the new training requirements. Keep in mind that even though we're increasing the amount per officer, this still won't go to the amount that the cities and local governments, sheriffs, law enforcement agencies spend across the state.
We're going to go through the bill with our three presenters and give an explanation of it, and then, like I said, after that, we'll have our House fiscal analyst explain the funding mechanism in the fiscal note. So if our three presenters would come up and... Either one of the three can begin your name and title. And
good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Denny Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which represents about 8,500 rank and file police officers throughout the state of Minnesota. I am here this morning along with my two colleagues representing a coalition of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, the Minnesota State Sheriff's Association, the Post Board, and my group that formed a coalition to back in September, actually, and we have had several meetings throughout the late fall and early part of this year in an effort to examine the training model that we currently have for peace officers in Minnesota, making a sincere effort to listen to various communities within our state that definitely had some opinions and some concerns about police training. And what House File 346 is a product of exactly that. And what we're proposing are really significant changes to police training in Minnesota. And number one, we're proposing that we remove the Peace Officer Training Fund from its special revenue account where it has been for decades, and move it to a general fund, a general fund directly to the Post Board in their base budget. And that would bring about a significant increase in dollars that would be available and that would be provided to every law enforcement agency in the state. Right now, just to let you know, that special revenue account last year brought in about $2.8 million. And once that was divided up by the Post Board and sent out, it averaged just a little bit over $300 a year to train peace officers. This proposal, if it would be so adopted, would increase that to about $1,000 a year. So, it does call for a significant commitment from the legislature to assist local governments in their job of training officers. And but along with that increase, we're proposing required training for officers or mandated training for peace officers in order for them to renew their license. And I'm going to let Nate go into more detail. But, again, we put a lot of thought in this, and it is the collective group of all of the law enforcement agencies that I mentioned. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nate.
Mr. Gold, go ahead with your name and title and begin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Nate Gulva. I'm the Executive Director of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, known as the Post Board. So the section of the bill that requires ongoing in-service for current working officers mandated training is in the three topic areas that the Chair mentioned: conflict management and mediation, mental health and crisis response, and valuing community and cultural diversity and differences. Those areas are 16 CEs. They are patterned after our updated learning objectives that the board adopted in April of 2015. And we've already established learning objectives for those as at least a starting point going forward. Officers would be required to have a minimum of 16 CEs in these three areas. the combination of which determined by their local elected sheriff or chief of police. And these areas, we would, the post board is in a position to track these to ensure that officers receive those once they're within their three-year licensing cycle. So it'd be about one-third of the current required 48 CEs that would have a dedicated portion. And just to note, there is 8 hours of emergency vehicle. That's required every 5 years currently, and annual use of force as well. So we're mindful of that to allow appropriate discretionary training for jurisdictions and their chiefs and sheriffs to determine for their officers.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Gold. Chief, if you would like to begin.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, this section that I'll talk about is Section 8. This is what we call the Pathways to Policing Reimbursement Grant portion of the bill. This is in response to the challenges that law enforcement is facing in hiring right now. Many departments are finding it very difficult to find candidates in terms of the quantity, but we're also finding a particular challenge in finding candidates that help us become more diverse, that has become more reflective of the communities that we're serving from a diversity standpoint. This segment would allow for some reimbursement through grants to help hire candidates through a non-traditional hiring process. The traditional hiring process, just really quickly, is candidates that come to us as applicants who either are already licensed as a peace officer in another city or are eligible to be licensed because they've successfully passed the peace officer standards and training exam and they're completed a program prior to that that put them in a position to take the licensing exam. What this program does is it allows cities, agencies to hire a candidate who have at least a two-year degree from an accredited university. Some cities may choose to have higher than that, but at a baseline kind of minimum. And then we would then send them to a program that has already been created where we would then provide them with the training to learn kind of the theory side of it, also the kind of skills-related training. It takes about 15 weeks. They would then take that post-exam, and they would come back to the agency that hired them and start their training within the agency. This would allow people who are already in a different career field to cross over and enter the law enforcement career. It allows us to go out and do a little more, quite a bit more recruiting in terms of trying to become more diverse and be more reflective of our communities that we serve. Currently, there's really no pathway for those candidates that are in a career already to cross over without having to either go to school full-time and work full-time in a variety of other challenges that make that very, very difficult for them to do. And that's why I think we're seeing the challenges that we're just not finding the applicants, we're not finding the quantity of applicants that are going to put us in a position to more closely reflect the communities that we serve. This portion just calls for kind of cost-sharing with the agency. There is a cost for that training, $6,000 to $7,000, maybe a little bit more. That is the training that gets them 15 or 16 weeks, gets them ready to take the post-exam. And then they're also hired as an employee, so they're working for an agency prior to being a sworn or licensed peace officer, and there's a cost associated with that. Frank, that makes it very difficult for some cities to participate in this, and so this would just provide, like I said, in some kind of a cost-sharing program between those agencies that want to participate and this program that we're trying to develop.
Okay, thank you, Chief. We have Representative Becker Finn has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chief Potts, I just wanted to say I know at least one of the police chiefs in my district, we've talked specifically about this issue, about different ways to get people into the field. I was wondering if you could just, for everybody's education, the typical route that folks would take, how much does that cost? As far as, you know, the degree or the program you would have to take and then the licensing exam.
Chief?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair and members, the typical cost is paid for by the candidate, and I could defer to the post board representative up here to kind of talk about the cost of that. But the city, in most cases, doesn't bear the cost of any of that. It's all on the candidate. And that's kind of the challenge when you're working in some other career field is to, you may have this desire to cross over into law enforcement at some point, but the cost of the education, and frankly the time that you have to commit to going to those classes is nearly full-time, and in many cases it is full-time, and as they're trying to juggle full-time employment somewhere else, it makes it very difficult. But I'll defer to Mr. Gove here to kind of outline the cost of that program.
Mr. Gove, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's so if traditional students typically get a two-year degree, certainly costs for a bachelor's degree will be more expensive, but the current 68 credits is what's required. I don't have the specific costs of what Metro State or St. Cloud charges per 3 to 4 credit class, but it's pretty significant in the practical application. The sort of the skills portion is typically a 12 credit program, so it's significant. And with that is, you know, that is correct. It is all shared by the candidates to become post eligible.
A follow up?
Yeah. I would just want to make the point that this this pathway program would be really needed and necessary as far as getting in those candidates who might not have the means to have the typical 2-year, 4-year degree path to becoming an officer. Thank you.
And Representative Johnson, we got a few of them here. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, question I have is for this program, is this similar to the one that the State Patrol is now doing for those that aren't? Because they've switched from requiring a post. They do both. They have some classes that are just post-eligible already and some that they do a program where they take a 2-year college degree or greater and give them the skills portion. I'm just wondering if this is going to be a similar program.
Chief?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it is similar. It is similar in the sense that the program that we would be sending the candidates to is very similar. The difference here is that this would be kind of a collaboration of many, many different departments. For the most part, the program the State Patrol does in Minneapolis PD is singular to their department. They hire and fill that class with all either troopers or, in Minneapolis's case, Minneapolis officers. But this would be a way for other agencies to kind of collaborate, kind of share in the process of kind of putting this on. And so it would be a class, really, of cadets or candidates from all different departments throughout the metro or throughout the state. But the content of the program is very similar.
Mr. Chair, I do like this idea because it could actually increase the possible candidates to get much better law enforcement officers, candidates out there, although we do have some great law enforcement personnel already.
Okay, thank you. Representative Howe, Dean, and Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess going on off that same lines, I do have one question that follows up that. If that's the case and they're very similar to Minneapolis and the State Patrol, has there been any thought or any consideration or discussions about just making that all one big academy? And then they could do all that together instead of having three separate academies. Why aren't we teaching everyone the same thing, and they could piece out and do their own little piece after that? But are we not teaching all the same things, and why aren't we having then one collaborative academy?
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I could answer that. Currently, it's a capacity issue for the current provider, which is Hennepin Technical College, which is a certified peace officer training program. So it has more to do with the size, but I don't believe that this section of the bill, it doesn't. There are other certified programs throughout the state that certainly could enter into that, where you could potentially have all of them operating at the same time. But it's just a matter of students that they can handle at any one time up there for this specialized program.
Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is it sounds like that discussion has never happened about collaborative, bringing all that together in one location and do it, because they do have the space up at Camp Ripley where the State Patrol does theirs. That would, to me, be an unlimited location that you could do whatever you needed to do, and if you wanted to put that all together, you could do that. The other question I have, though, and I would encourage you to go down that road and have that discussion and look to that. The other question I have is most of the licensing in the state of Minnesota has gone from a three-year license to a two-year license. Why hasn't the Post Board also done that same thing and they've retained a three-year license? Every certification or license that I have from the state used to be a three-year license. It is now a two-year license. How come the Post Board is the only one I'm aware of that hangs out there as continuing to be a three-year license?
Mr. Grove.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in terms of when they have to be relicensed, is that your question? I think the feedback from local law enforcement over the history of the Post Board has been that given the required ongoing CEs by the agencies, is to be able to give them enough time to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow up if I may, but I will say that the rest of us out there didn't want to go to a two-year recertification either because, I had to meet the same number of CEUs. They actually adjusted the CEUs I had to take, which we could do here also, mm-hmm. but it sure cost me a lot more money every time I had to go. But I don't see the relevance. I just bring up the point that what's good for the goose should be good for the gander, I guess.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a lot of questions. I mean, do you want me to go now or do you want me to focus on one area? So let's go back to the pathways to policing reimbursement, and I think this would be either for the police chief or other folks. So when you say non-traditional, I mean, is that defined at all? I have an architecture degree. Could I apply into this program tomorrow and become a sworn officer after I take the post-exam in 4 months?
Chief or whoever on
Mr. Sponsor. Chair and Representative, I believe you could. Two-year degree is the minimum from an accredited university, and so when we talk about non-traditional, it isn't necessarily specifically defined in this. It could mean to the chief of police in Hastings, Minnesota, or Hutchinson, Minnesota, a candidate who lives in or grew up in that community and is currently working in some career field that financially it doesn't. There's no pathway for him to cross over. But the chief from Hutchinson would love to hire that person because you know what that's going to happen? You know what's going to happen when he does that? Is that police officer is going to stay in Hutchinson for his whole career. Instead of taking that job in Hutchinson as kind of a starter job and moving to the metro area, he would love this program because it will allow him to hire some people from kind of a non-traditional background to cross over into law enforcement and stay in Hutchinson. It could mean non-traditional in the sense that people who didn't grow up wanting to be a police officer and going to college right after high school, getting the required academic things out of the way and taking the post-test in living in the metro. And this program would allow for those folks to apply with the minimum requirements. What we think when we start talking about how it would help us become more diverse is we don't see a tremendous amount of diversity in the current processes. I work in Bloomington. We're hiring police officers right now. We're participating in both a traditional and a non-traditional hiring process. So we're actually interviewing for people in a process that we're talking about here today. We're also interviewing for a more traditional. When it comes down to the final phases of the hiring process, there's little to no ethnic diversity in that hiring pool. And so it will allow us to, I think, be a little bit more diverse in terms of our overall hiring processes because, quite frankly, we've already started the process and we're seeing the candidate pool for this quite diverse. And we think the quality of the candidates going to kind of be in this process at the end are going to allow us to hire in a way that's going to make us be more reflective of our community. So when we talk about non-traditional, it's non-traditional in their background. It's also, from a diversity standpoint, a much more diverse pool of candidates for us to draw from. And so there's no set definition for it. It kind of depends on where you're from right now in Minnesota. Non-traditional in a smaller city in rural Minnesota might mean just somebody who's working in a different career field.
Representative.
And if I could follow up to that question before I get to other questions. So you had talked about the increase in diversity aspect of it. We're speaking about ethnically, racially diverse Is there any sort of concerted effort that's truly purposeful? And maybe this would be for Director Flaherty, within the organizations to actually get out into communities to talk to individuals, to try to present maybe a different way of thinking about being a peace officer than oftentimes what we see on the news at 10 o'clock at night?
Mr. Flaherty or Chief Quinn?
Well, Chief Quinn. Mr. Chair and Representative, there are a lot of things going on in that on that front, and I'll speak to what I know about specifically in Bloomington, and then I can defer to Mr. Flaherty to talk about some of that stuff that may be going on kind of on a more statewide level. But absolutely, we're looking at ways within our own communities. We're in the high schools. We have Explorer programs where we're recruiting people to come be a part of the program at a very early age to see if they have any interest in law enforcement whatsoever. And we also are trying to do it through our community service programs. Those are non-sworn positions within a law enforcement agency where we're definitely out recruiting and targeting people from our community to help us, that will eventually help us kind of match our community from a demographic standpoint. This is just another avenue for us to go down to work on that. Issue of becoming more diverse, but there are absolutely a lot of different initiatives going on within the city of Bloomington, and I would imagine statewide to address this issue. But at the end of the day, they just haven't proven to be very successful yet, and so that's why we're trying a bunch of different approaches to try to overall have a little better success in this whole effort. But I'll defer now to Mr. Flaherty for some of the other programs.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I can assure you that. Every department that in a community that has a diverse community spends a tremendous amount of time recruiting, whether it's St. Paul or Minneapolis or the State Patrol. You take St. Paul, I'm most familiar with that. They not only are always out recruiting African Americans, but Asians, Somalis, they have... they go into high schools. They do everything that they can to do a reach out to young, to kids, frankly, and young adults to try to get them interested in a career in law enforcement. They, many of them have been tremendously creative in their efforts, and they spend a lot of time and a lot of resources. And, as the chief said, oftentimes not to a great deal of success. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to be a cop. Let's face it, not everybody is able to be a cop. The program that the chief is talking about is just yet another vehicle to have people that may be interested in a career of law enforcement. They already have a college degree, but they don't have, within that degree, they didn't have the curriculum necessary to become a cop. This is an opportunity to switch careers. They don't, they get paid a salary while they're getting this, and hopefully the end result is that they will be police officers once the program. So, I think anybody that has any other ideas, they'd be very welcomed. I mean, a lot of these departments have people working full time. Recruiting. I know the State Patrol has a diversity officer. Her entire job is to go out to every job fair, every high school, college, you name it. There, and Minneapolis is right along with them. They're all trying to compete for oftentimes the same individuals. But I think they need to be commended for trying. Can't brag about the results, but the effort is there. I can assure you,
Representative Dean.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I hope when we're talking about this, we're also talking about gender, because I think women on the force have a very different approach oftentimes to how they police, and that creates an environment that I think could be really good for the citizens throughout the state.
We, of course, are talking about that, yes.
So when I look at the 16 hours over 3 years, there's these three areas, and there's no definition of what area. I mean, is it possible for a particular department to have training just in one area versus all three, since there's no minimum requirement, like a minimum of 4 hours in at least one of the areas or things like that? Is that something, and maybe I'll loop it right back, is that something that then gets kicked back to the post board as far as how it's setting up the rules and the guidelines for training? Is that something that we just don't know enough about yet, but we know we need to do something differently? If you could just respond to that. And before you do that, can you also speak to the issue of implicit bias and where that might fall within these three categories?
Mr. Gove.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, so on your first question, certainly the expectation from the Post Board standpoint would be that the chief law enforcement officer would have to ensure that all that their officers receive training in all three categories. And under current Post rules, the minimum would be one continuing education hour, as that we don't have it in fractions to actually authorize our training. Given the level of different learning objectives, I would be surprised if there would be a one-hour class. But in terms of the actual breakdown, whether it's going to be an eight-hour class, a couple of four-hour classes, or three six-hour classes, that will be determined by the different providers of the education and how they meet the different learning objectives. And concerning your question on implicit bias, the board is already in the process of amending. That has been a recommendation under our cultural valuing cultural differences, as to ensure that that language is in there. That's been a request from the colleges and universities, as we know that's an important piece of that as well. And that may be a class in and of itself within that heading.
Great. And two more questions, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So one is, as I think about this, and it's just because I may not know, I know that, you know, many of the unions and folks have contracts with their jurisdiction in which there are certain things that are spelled out. Would this then override anything that's currently in place, and then those contracts would have to be modified accordingly, or is this sort of something that's falling completely outside of agreements within the police union and the jurisdiction?
Chief.
Mr. Chair and Representative, from our perspective, speaking from Bloomington, and they can add on, is we don't view there to be any contract implications to this at all.
Okay.
Good.
And then one last question. So we know that the governor convened the Council on Law Enforcement and Community Relations previously. They have not come out with a report on any recommendations at this time. My question is, have you been in conversations with those folks? You know, is this sort of a prelude to something that they may come with some recommendation, or is this something that, you know, quite frankly, you're all thinking might assist in, there might be some contradictions between what they might recommend and what you folks are all thinking right now?
Before you answer that, I could say that I've been in conversation with Mr. Burroughs, who I think, is he a co-chair?
He's the governor's inclusion officer.
Yeah, and he seemed rather excited about the training when I talked to him, but he hasn't mentioned any other types of training, but maybe you folks can follow up.
Mr. Chair, I do serve on that commission, as well as Nate and representatives of the chiefs and the sheriffs, and in fact, we presented this to the commission last week at a meeting, and I can say without reservation there was a great deal of enthusiasm. People came up to me afterwards and thought it was definitely the way to go. They were very supportive of the increase in training dollars, and they very much liked the concept of mandated training. They liked the topics. There was a little bit of discussion about implicit bias versus how we're how it's being worded. But I can say, there was no vote taken, nor did we ask them to. I don't know what the final outcome will be of the commission and their recommendations, but I don't think they're going to come till probably certainly way after committee deadline. And but there was good feelings about this proposal.
Okay, and not a question, but a statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
One thing that I would hope is, after the Post Board determines some of these rules and guidelines, that there's some type of community engagement and involvement in sort of that process. I know it may be a bit unusual in the method of working, but I think it would lend sort of an appearance of the importance of the community and folks being involved outside of the Post Board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative, thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this question sort of maybe goes a little bit to that comment by Representative Dean, which is I'm just wondering about kind of that quality assurance for the content. And I guess this goes to Mr. Gove, because my understanding that in general with the Post Board, there's sort of a couple of, you know, kind of broad guidelines, but then within that, providers really can prepare a real wide variety of classes. As we know, quality can really vary. And having just finished training a couple thousand officers myself statewide, my non would say, well, I guess just wondering, sort of what is the quality assurance to make sure that the content that's being provided really is helpful and make a difference?
Mr. Gove?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, so once the learning objectives are determined through our training subcommittee and then implemented by the full board, our continuing education coordinator, Mary Bjornberg, who's been with Pulse 30 years, mm-hmm. she goes through our rules process to ensure that the classroom instructional materials, what the framework is to ensure that there's at least 50 minutes per one CE of classroom-type instruction. We do allow online as well, that the instructors have the appropriate credentials and to actually look through the overall outlines and materials to ensure that it meets the stated learning objectives. But that's one of the reasons why we try to keep them as encompassing as possible, realizing it's very difficult to have one class fit all. And so from a provider standpoint, that's very important, certainly, because we know if it's mandated training, there will be a dedicated demand to it. We have to make sure that we can supply that.
Chief, if you want to comment, keep it real short because we want to move on.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, just from a practical standpoint, too, the Chiefs Association is committed to helping produce training, high-quality training that not only meets the learning objectives but goes above and beyond that. We've acquired some equipment so we can do training in a studio that's recorded, that's interactive with our chiefs all over the state, and we're committed to, if this goes through, to producing that specific to these new requirements. And quite frankly, I think that the training that we're going to see from a use of force standpoint throughout the state of Minnesota, with these additions, you'll start to see training kind of use of force training re-engineered to include these specific learning objectives. So crisis intervention along with what would be the traditional use of force. We think that this will create a situation where you're going to see improved training across all of the required areas with these changes.
Mr. Chair, so I guess based on the answer from Mr. Gove and based on my own experience, it does seem like, yeah, that these objectives end up being really particularly important because I think a lot of the review ends up being somewhat more logistical in terms of credentials and minutes and things as opposed to really being able to dive in a lot into the content. So I think that a lot of the, I guess maybe my question back to Chief Potts is it seems like a lot of the control and the quality to a certain extent is departments deciding this particular option is worth the time for me to send my officers to versus that option. It's mandatory, but as far as which provider I'm going to choose the one that's highest quality. Am I right in understanding that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, to a certain degree, yes, but that's why what comes with this is some higher level of funding. So there are specific providers that are kind of the top echelon in terms of the quality, but those don't come at a low cost. And so we think that with the request in terms of the appropriation for this, that you're going to see the quality come with that training as well.
Okay, then I guess, Mr. Chair, then just two very brief comments supporting what Representative Dean said. One is that I do think that then with those objectives being so important, that making sure that there's community input along the way, I guess it really would encourage. And then similarly, I know I've been contacted by several constituents and community members as well with this point about implicit bias, that just encourage the author and the law enforcement leaders to consider putting that language in to the actual language of the bill, and not at all to single out a law enforcement in any way, implicit bias, something that's in every single one of us, but if we're going to be addressing this, that might be something to include. I'm certainly very supportive of the bill and appreciate the chair and the law enforcement committee bringing it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, and then after her question, we'll call up a person from the League of Minnesota Cities and then move to the fiscal analyst. Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a really quick clarifying question. Representative Becker-Finn brought up a good point, and I'm kind of a numbers person, so I was trying to figure out what that number might be that you had asked about. But what I need to know to figure that out, basically, is what the pathways to policing actually covers, because it says compensating and training. So I did look at Metro State's website and figured out what it would be. So including the skills, including the tuition and fees, not including books because it doesn't have that listed, but it's just shy of $20,000 for 2 year, all the credits that you had talked about. So I'm just curious what else the pathways to policing actually includes besides tuition and fees. Is there something else, books or... It said compensating, so I'm just curious what else it covers for the $1 million. And, you know, if it was just half of just tuition and fees, that's 100 participants, but maybe there's more to it.
Chief.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, that would be a that would cover the cost of the tuition for the candidates. We're now, depending on the number of candidates in a particular class, it's between $6,000 and $8,000 per candidate. There, because this is a program that you're hiring the employee 15 to 20 weeks prior to when they would typically start as a police officer, there's wages that go along with it while they're attending the course and the benefits that go along with being an employee of a municipality. And so the package for those two things is around $20,000 to $25,000 per hire, per cadet. There's also some equipment needs that they need prior to going to the course currently being taught by Hennepin Tech. We estimate those in $1,000 to $2,000 per candidate. And so those are the expenses. We don't know how many cities are going to want to participate in this. We think that there's a very good chance that if it's successful, we'll see it really increase with next year. This is really kind of a trial run. We think that cities will see this as an is really a new opportunity for them to hire non-traditional candidates, and so you may see a considerably larger group next year. There was a point raised earlier about this being, you know, similar to the state patrol. Let me just clarify. We do in fact have two officers from a municipality going through the state patrol program right now. The problem with this, with co-locating specifically with the state patrol, is it increases the cost considerably when all of the people that go to this have to go up to Camp Ripley, and we think that a more regionalized approach might help cities participate. So there would be an opportunity perhaps in the metro. Maybe there's an opportunity annually at Camp Ripley. We're looking at this as something that we can do maybe all over the state and make it easier for those municipalities to hire people. We know that when they send them away that there's increased costs that go along with that, and so it's we think what we're asking for here would be very helpful in terms of some kind of a cost-sharing equation to allow more cities to participate.
Representative O'Neill.
So I think what I heard you say is it's about $32,000 added all up per participant. And so if we have $1 million, that's about 30 people that we can kind of get trained to get out there. Is that correct?
That's a 50% too. For it's a cost sharing. It says at the end of there it's 50%.
Yep.
So, you know, that would double that number, right?
Okay. Thank you.
Steve, thank you. Did you want to comment just quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question about is there any obligation for these cadets or these officers to stay in the program or stay in the employment of law enforcement for a number of years? Is there any obligation to to pay that training fee or cost back if they don't stay in there for like 5 years? Because I know I went through the program. I was non-traditional. I put in my time in service. I paid for my college with the GI Bill, and I paid for the skills portion of it a time later in life. And there was an obligation for me to stay in law enforcement for at least 5 years, and then my debt was forgiven. So if this is going to be something where they're going to receive training, is there any kind of obligation for them to remain there?
Just a yes or no, I think it'd be good.
Chair and Representative, there's discussions about some kind of a two-year requirement. It's in discussion phase at this point. We don't have it quite clarified in terms of how that would work with our HR representative.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to see five.
There's probably goods and bads about that.
Yeah.
I mean, we need a cop that wants to be a cop. We don't want somebody out there that gets happy to do the course and says, I've had enough, because we need somebody to really believe in the program, but we can talk about it. Testifier from the League of Minnesota Cities, David, pronounce your own name. Go ahead and give your name and your title and begin. And just a short summary of whether you support the bill in line.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Unmacht. I'm the executive director of the League of Minnesota Cities, a statewide association representing 833 of Minnesota's 853 cities. My testimony will be very brief this morning. I'm here today bringing more than three decades of experience in local government administration, working in tandem and in partnership with law enforcement officers, deputies, police chiefs, and county sheriffs, and many other officials within and throughout the criminal justice system. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 346. The issues this bill will help to address are concerns that are being discussed in city council chambers and community forums throughout the state and cities of all sizes, representing law enforcement agencies with distinct and different needs and goals. They're also being discussed in the League's boardroom, which serves as a collective barometer and sounding board for the issues facing our cities. In fact, one of the League's board directive legislative priorities for 2017 is passage of legislation aimed at enhancing collaboration and trust through improving relationships between law enforcement officers and agencies in the communities that they serve. The League supports the House File 346 for several reasons. First, the League supports training in the areas specified in the bill, crisis intervention and mental illness crises, conflict management and mediation, and recognizing and valuing community diversity and cultural differences. Second, the League supports efforts to bring persons with non-traditional backgrounds into law enforcement. The line of questions that we just had addressed that. As a complete aside, in my business, which is local government administration, the principle of non-traditional candidates is real as well, so it's something that we see in this area of local government in addition to law enforcement. The grants provided in House File 346 for this purpose will help advance this important work. Thirdly, the League appreciates the level of funding provided in the bill. The funding will defray the cost of complying with the bill's mandates for local agencies and their taxpayers. And then finally, the bill provides flexibility, which is really important. It allows the officer and his or her agency to choose the type of training that is the best fit. This is very important policy consideration for our communities and our city councils. The League's experience with delivering training has proven that providing training options is critical to meeting the needs of agencies that, as you know, have vastly different needs and capacities. Should this bill become law, the League will actively partner with the Peace Officers Standards and Training Board, as we have over many years, to deliver high-quality and cost-effective training to the officers who serve our communities. We know firsthand that our cities and our law enforcement community want to do the right thing, yet are faced with constraints and challenges unlike any other time in my local government career. Thank you, Representative Cornish and Representative Hillstrom and each of the co-authors for bringing this bill forward, and I stand for any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Now, if we could have our fiscal analyst review the fiscal note and give us some information.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll just quickly point out the four sections in the bill that deal with the fiscal implications before moving to the fiscal note. So, Mr. Chair, on starting with Section 1. Section 1 is a non-DWI driver's license reinstatement fee. And on the top of the second page, those revenues which were currently flowing to the Special Revenue Fund, which funds the Post Board and the training reimbursements, is changed to the General Fund. And that represents about $125,000 a year that would go from the Special Revenue Fund now to the General Fund. Section 2 changes the disbursement of surcharges, and the 1% that originally went to the Department of Natural Resources would remain. The 39% that had gone to the Post Board for both operations and for the reimbursements would be reduced to a percentage that would supply the Post Board with money to fund their operations. And I believe the intent of the bill is to not fund the training reimbursements, as was stated by the testimony, from the Special Revenue Fund anymore. It would just be for operations, and any remaining receipts would flow to the General Fund. Mr. Chair, at the very end of the bill, on the final page, there are two appropriations which they spoke of, the $10 million per year, which would be ongoing for training reimbursements, to the Post Board, and $1 million per year to the Department of Public Safety for the pathway to policing, And again, that is ongoing. So, Mr. Chair, moving to the fiscal note, which was in your packets, about 15 minutes before the start of committee today, we received the final fiscal note. There was one slight change from the preliminary that is in your packets, and that is, as you can see, in 2018, the preliminary note assumed that the $10 million the first year for training reimbursements would be reduced by $33,000, which would go for some IT, a small amount of IT, and a little bit of materials to the post board that would reduce the $10 million the first year. They've since amended that to request an additional $33,000 to pay for that, so that's the change. It would not come from the reimbursements the first year, but they'd be looking for an additional $33,000 to fund those small ancillary costs. So, Mr. Chair, what you see on the top line is essentially the post board, the general fund, the $10 million a year for training reimbursements would now come from the general fund. Moving down to public safety, the $875 is the $1 million a year for pathway policing, reduced by the $125,000 from that first reinstatement fee, that $125,000 that would now go to the general fund. That's a net figure. They're also looking for $30,000 a year in 2019 ongoing to fund additional training costs for the state patrol. So, Mr. Chair, you can see the cost of this bill is roughly $22 million per biennium to the general fund. However, I would state that the current training reimbursements to the post board out of the special revenue fund is about $5.5 million per biennium. If the intent, and I believe it is to eliminate the special revenue fund training reimbursements and replace them with this larger $10 million from the general fund, the elimination of the special revenue fund appropriation would reduce the cost of this bill from $22 million per biennium to $16.5 million, and I believe that's the intent.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, are there any questions?
Any questions on that? I can also say that I've had a personal communication with the governor. His bill is a little different, the governor's staff recommendation, than ours, but he said that he was excited about it and looking forward to working with us on it. So, with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might make a comment.
Well, I was going to recognize you. Yeah, that's just what I was going to get into. My co-author, Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it really clear for the folks that maybe didn't understand all the conversation about the fiscal note. One of the goals of this bill is to take the $9 that used to come from traffic tickets and to no longer make that go for training for law enforcement. It is delinking traffic tickets from law enforcement training. It now says the state is going to pay for all law enforcement training straight from the general fund. It is a priority for us. The other thing that this bill makes very, very clear is for the first time law enforcement has come forward and said, we want you to mandate these kinds of training, and it is the first time anywhere in Minnesota that this has happened. So now we'll have this mandate of crisis response, conflict management, and cultural diversity training. So I appreciate all the work that has gone into this bill. I appreciate all the listening that has happened in trying to come up with something that bipartisanly folks could support. And I'm very, very excited about the alternative pathways to add diversity to our law enforcement community. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'd like to give the large majority of the credit to the MPPOA, the chiefs, the sheriff, and the post board coalition for bringing this to us. Now, is there any public testimony out there? Okay, thank you very much. Anything else? The chair would renew his motion that House File 346, as amended, would be recommended to go to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much.
Okay, and now a civil legal services budget request. Either one of you would like to begin with your name and title and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Ann Hefkin. I am the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota, and I am here to do the easy part of today's testimony, which is simply to do the introductions of our coalition members. As you may recall from our overview presentation, Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is a number of nonprofits that together serve all 87 counties in Minnesota and provide no-cost legal services for non-criminal cases for low-income people. To my left, who's going to do the heavy lifting today, is Kathy Hockadoff, the Executive Director of the Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid Program, which covers the central part of the state. And I'd like to introduce Bob Friday. He's just such a great name. His name is Bob Friday, and he's in the Virginia Office of Legal Services of Northwest, the northwest part of the state, greater Minnesota, my counterpart, and then Jesse Nicholson from southern Minnesota. Northeast. Virginia's in the Northeast. I'm Northwest, so I get a little biased towards Northwest. So my program covers about 30% of the state in the Northwest. Mr. Friday's program covers the Northeast. And Jesse Nicholson is the southern Minnesota. So with those introductions, again, I just want to clarify that we all together represent all 87 counties, greater Minnesota and the metro. And Kathy is going to present the budget request.
Yes, for the record, I'm Kathy Hockadoll. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our budget. There is a small handout with your materials. The first page just is a refresher of what we said in our overview, that there are three sources of the Supreme Court's state-administered funding, and the largest, obviously, is the general fund appropriation that goes to the Supreme Court to be passed through as grants to civil legal services programs across the state. The others are other funding sources from the court generated by various aspects of attorney registration fees and lawyers' trust account. The next page is an overview of the total funding from all sources for our network. We are obviously seeking funding because we are nonprofits from a lot of different sources. But clearly, the general fund appropriation is critical for the work we do for people with low incomes, people with disabilities, and seniors throughout the state, because that constitutes 36% of the network's funding. The third page is a little more information about our budget request. We are asking for a $1.9 million per year increase in $1.9 million in each year, not additional the second year. Of our funding, and there are three reasons for it. The first, that would constitute about $825,000, if we can get our full request, is for salary improvement. Civil legal services attorneys have the lowest salaries of any attorneys in the public sector, and frankly are still at their pre-recession level. We all had salary freezes. Most of us also had salary reductions during the period of the recession. Our starting salary is at an average of $46,600 per year, and the salaries go up very, very little each year, usually only a few hundred dollars a year for each attorney. In contrast, every single other attorney in the public sector has a starting salary of at least $50,000. The public defenders are at $55,000. County attorneys are at $50,000 and higher. In the metro, they're substantially higher than that. They're above the public defenders. The state judicial clerks are at $50,000 and higher. And the Attorney General's Office and state government agencies are all higher than the public defenders. We're not saying that any of these should be decreased or requested increases shouldn't be granted for other attorneys in the system, but the fact is our salaries are not at all competitive, and it is having a harmful effect on our ability to serve the most vulnerable people in the state in achieving safety for them, preventing homelessness, and achieving basic economic security. We've had significantly increased attorneys turnover in our attorneys, especially in attorneys with a 3 to 9 year level of experience. because they come to us because they have a passion for the work we do. They want to serve the most vulnerable in our community with their law degree on civil matters, but they frankly cannot sustain working at the office, our offices, and therefore they go to other public sector jobs where they can make a lot more money. Virtually all of the folks in this category who leave our office go to another public service job. They do not, they very rarely go to the private sector. For example, three attorneys in this range, actually the 3 to 6 year range, who left my program in the past few months, all obtained jobs in the public sector where they made a minimum of $20,000 more than they were making with us. One of them went to a job where she is making $29,000 more than she made with us. Young attorneys can't afford to stay with us because they graduate from law school with huge loans. The tuition at the University of Minnesota Law School, for example, is $40,000 a year, and our starting salary is $45,000 or $46,000 a year across our programs. And they also, if they want to consider buying a house, that compounds the debt that they're already facing. The bottom line, it really ends up affecting how many people we can serve because we are now in a mode of continuous recruitment and training. And as all of you know from the different walks you come from, when any organization is in a mode of constant recruiting and training, it has an impact on the amount of people you can serve. With the kind of high-quality service we still expect from ourselves no matter what. We also have fewer candidates for some of our positions, particularly in greater Minnesota. The amount we've requested would improve salaries by about 4%. Our ultimate goal would be to reach a starting salary of $50,000 for our attorneys, and obviously that would mean some adjustments across all of our positions, but really focusing on the less experienced attorneys. The second category of our budget request is that we would also like to apply money to offset increases in fixed costs that we have all faced. The most significant is health insurance. We bid out, all of us, our health insurance every year to go with the lowest bidder, but there has been no bidder that hasn't gone up every single year in the past several years, as I know you know from other people you, your own lines of work, but also the other people you see testify. And the final area is we have experienced as a network losses in other areas of funding that we would hope to offset so that we can remain stable. Our total funding really has not grown because although you did give us an increase 2 years ago, and 4 years ago, and we very much appreciate that. Other areas of funding have decreased. The United Ways across the state have decreased funding. And some other funders, federal grantors, for example, have switched priorities so that funding for legal services to low-income people is not as much of a priority, and we bring in less money as a result. In addition, we'd like to use some of the increase to continue to improve our technological innovations, particularly our statewide innovations, the Law Help website, which is available to the general public and reaches many people that we turn away, our ProJustice website that supports all of the volunteer attorneys across the state, which we're very thankful for because that leverages our ability to do our work, our online intake program, which is centralized for, again, all over the state, and our online advice program, which is a volunteer attorney program that anyone across the state can access online. With that, I would ask Ms. Hufkin to add a couple of comments about the impact on the rural areas that she serves and others serve of particularly the salary improvement.
Yeah, in regards to the salary improvement, I just wanted to emphasize the point that although people in greater Minnesota, unless they want to move to the metro, we're not competing with the state agencies or those other employers that pay more, but we're still struggling to attract and retain high-quality people. And lacrosse sectors in greater Minnesota, as many of you are aware, the need for staff and employees is great, and it's true in our sector. It's true in the legal sector as well. So we want to keep those talented people in greater Minnesota, so we need to be able to attract them and keep them with increased salaries.
With that, we stand for questions. Thank you.
Okay, questions, members? No, I guess you're good to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Okay, now we have results first criminal justice benefit cost analysis report. Weston Merrick, whenever you're ready to begin, your name and title. And
thank you, Chair. One second while I get this up. Excellent. My name is Weston Merrick, and I'm with Minnesota Management and Budget. I lead the Results First initiative there. First, I'm going to be referencing a couple of documents today that are in your committee packets. The first is in, there are two inventories. They look like this. So the large documents. There's one with a blue top, that is the prison inventory. There's one with an orange top, that is the supervision inventory. I'll also be referencing a four-page document that is our full benefit cost analyses, and I'll point it out again when I get to that part of the presentation. It's also available for the audience members at the top in black and white, but they are labeled as well. In 2015, the legislature instructed MMB to do benefit cost analyses for corrections and human services programs. This is part of a broader initiative led by the Pew Charitable Trust and MacArthur Foundation. They're right now operating in 24 states doing this form of analysis. So Minnesota is part of a community of practice where we're learning what works and starting to look a little bit at cost effectiveness. But to be clear, I am a state employee. The legislature has funded our work on an ongoing basis. So when Pew started this work about 6 or 7 years ago in New Mexico, and what we've seen already in about the last 14 months that we've been doing this work is that policymakers really have incomplete data often on incomplete data available on many topics when they're building their budget. And we really saw three key questions that we wanted to fill with this project. The first question we saw that policymakers are often faced with is, what are we actually offering? What are the programs that we have in a programmatic area? For criminal justice, especially in supervision, we don't always have a great idea of what's going on because of the three delivery systems we have here in Minnesota. So when we worked with jurisdictions, when we went into those jurisdictions, when we went into those counties, there was never a full list available of the services that they offered in supervision, let alone having something that showed what we're doing across the state overall. Number two, what do these services actually cost? We know as, you know, as legislators and we know as agencies that there are many funding sources related to our offerings. There are state services, there are state pass-throughs, there are county levy dollars that go into this. So what do we actually have? Yes.
I was just going to say for the committee, I'm going to leave here, but it's not because I don't care. It's just because he's given me this presentation already, so I'm going to let Brian take over here. And so, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Question. Number three, and most importantly, and most acute, is if we deliver the service correctly, what are the outcomes that we should anticipate? We often have a lot of data about outputs. How many people we've put through a service. Maybe we have some information about the completion percentage on a certain type of treatment. But very rarely are we able to say that here are the declines in recidivism that we can anticipate, that we can say are caused by this service. And so this initiative allows us to answer those three questions and deliver it in a way that is useful in the policymaking process, both for institutional programs in our prisons and also for supervision programs. Now, this is not a silver bullet, and by no means is MMB the first to use evidence to improve client outcomes. Legislature discuss these outcomes every year and how we can do better. The agencies use data and evidence-based practices every day to consider how we can improve outcomes. Counties, in the same way, are thinking about these things. But I do believe this is a really strong tool that centralizes our outcome data and applies it in a way that's apples to apples so that we can compare services to one another. It is also is done by an independent group. MMB is not funding any of these directly. We are not applying any of these services directly, and so that independence is useful. Implicit in here is the goal to produce benefit cost estimates that are understood, trusted, and used by policymakers both at the state level and also at the local level. Our areas of focus right now are corrections and human services. I mentioned that this program is on an ongoing basis. We just started this year analysis in substance use disorder treatments, and we'll move soon to juvenile justice. In the future, we'll be looking at areas including children's welfare, children's mental health, preventative services, and there's a potential in the future to look at other services as well as every couple years refreshing this data and these analyses. We have an advisory committee that supports that aim. It's made up of the three relevant commissioners, MMB, DOC, DHS. We have six legislators, three House, three Senate, including your colleague, Representative O'Neill, a representative from the judicial branch, and four county folks that bring that local perspective. The general process that we follow is, first, we know this is a really decentralized system. There's data a lot of places. So there's a lot of stakeholders. So we work with the agencies, of course, the Department of Correction. We work with the Department of Public Services and DEED to look at the services that are being offered. And then we also work really closely with counties to see what they're doing. And those counties represent all three of our delivery systems. In this analysis, we included work and did gather data from Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted counties, Dakota, and Stearns. From the county probation officer side, we work with Moore, Itasca, and Wright counties. And then we, of course, work with the Department of Corrections in the counties where they administer probation and parole services. The next step is to actually inventory the programs. This is the what. I'll get into this a little bit more in just a bit. We then gather cost data. How much is this costing? That second question. And the first is, the third step is we run the model. This model answers the what are the outcomes that we should anticipate. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the statistical model because I know that's not the interest of most of the folks here. Welcome questions on it, but just a little bit of background. Our model comes out of Washington State Institute of Public Policy. They've been doing this form of analyses for about 20 to 25 years. Very interesting agency. They are a legislative agency in Washington State. They have about 15 to 20 researchers on staff, most of them with PhDs, and their job is to look at the rigorous academic literature and advise the legislature on what works, and also provide some estimates of the cost-effectiveness, the benefit-cost analyses. Through our partnership with Pew, we get access to this model for free and some technical assistance as well to help sure and make sure that we apply it correctly. The final thing we're doing is presenting these findings, of course, to the legislature, bringing it to agencies, sharing it with counties and associations on how we can improve and increase the amount of services that we offer that we know work. The one thing you do not see in here, which is really important, is evaluation. MMB is not going into the field, following a service, setting a treatment and control group, let's say intensive supervised release. We're not actually following the participants in there for 5 years, seeing the outcomes that we get from those participants. Instead, what we're doing is we're relying on the already available, rigorously done, local evaluations and evaluations from across the country. Now, that comes with a big assumption. When we use those pieces of evidence from across the country, we're assuming that we're going to see the same impact here in Minnesota. It's an important assumption that we like to be very clear on. The benefit of this assumption is that we get to leverage thousands of academic journals on what works in corrections as well as in other programmatic areas. So here's our inventory I referenced at the beginning. The two documents, one has a blue top, one has an orange top. I'll walk through a little bit of what is in the inventory and what it does and how we came up with it. The far left column you'll see in both inventories is the service itself, followed by a description of the service. So what is it? Who's the treatment population? How long is it? How intensive is it on average? Who is delivering these services and maybe who's paying for it as well? And then we have a column in the middle, and we call this impact on outcomes or impact on recidivism. And this is what the academic literature, the rigorous evidence, tells us about how effective the service is. Now, it's very important. We only looked at one outcome in this analysis yet far, and that is recidivism. These services may also improve other outcomes, outcomes like employment or institutional safety, or decrease the incidence of domestic abuse. These are very important outcomes. We've just looked here at recidivism. In the future, we hope to include more outcome measures here, but that's a very important note. The four categories that you will see in here, the very top category is proven effective. Now, this means that multiple rigorous studies have told us that this service is going to generate positive impacts on recidivism. We're going to see reductions in recidivism. Now, when I say rigorous research, that can mean a lot of things. So we have a very specific definition. What we're looking for in here are studies that are of an experimental design or quasi-experimental design. In normal parlance, we can think of it as a medical trial. We have a treatment group, the control group, that are like in every other way, except the treatment group received the service, let's say, again, intensive supervised release, and the control group got services as normal. Now, we require that type of study because it tells us something very unique, and that is that there is a causal relationship between the service and the outcome. We can say that intensive supervised release caused declines in recidivism. And so that's why we require that specific type of research. There are other pieces of research that are very well done and very useful, and we talk about that a bit in the last column, which is Voices from the Field. But top-level proven effective, multiple studies have told us that this works. Second column down is promising. Promising categories, we see good outcomes on recidivism, but perhaps there's only one study available or two studies available. We could use some more information here. Number three down is theory-based. Consider these neutral. We do not yet have that medical trial design that we need to be able to say that this service is generating, that is causing the outcomes that we want. These are areas that we could explore further and have the opportunity to evaluate to see how effective they are. The next category down is a category of services. This is essentially a bucket. There were some services where we either didn't have the manpower to dig in very deeply, or maybe the services in this bucket didn't have a definite model or design or curriculum. The one that I have listed up here is mental health supervision and treatment coordination. We decided there were a lot of things in this bucket, and we decided to look at it in a more intentional way in our mental health report. Another one that you'll see in the prison institution inventory is enrichment services. These include a wide range of things that we fund and we pay for, things like a library, things like computer lab, things like recreational activities that maybe not, don't follow a curriculum. We wanted to make sure that we had it in the inventory that it's something that we're doing. The final level is no effect on recidivism. That means that rigorous studies have told us, or at least one rigorous study has told us, that we have no effect on recidivism related to this service. Now, I can take some questions about those services later on, but again, I will reiterate that there may be other reasons why we do those things. Maybe it's institutional safety, maybe it is able to save us some money, or maybe we have other outcomes in mind when we do that service. And we can go into greater depth later on if you'd like. So those are the two inventories. We also, of course, did a full benefit cost analysis for a subset of these services. Now, when I say benefit cost analyses, I want to be clear on what we mean, and I'm speaking to this four-pager right here. Later on in the four-pager, you'll see things like $7, a benefit cost ratio of $7. But what that means is that for a dollar that we put in, we're going to see $7 in benefits. over the course of, in this study, we measured it for 5 years. Now, that $7 is broken into multiple categories. We have societal benefits, and we have taxpayer benefits. Taxpayer benefits are things that governments do. Things like if we have a service that works, let's say cognitive behavioral therapy, we know this service works, it reduces recidivism. We're going to see declines in things like arrests, prison time, jail, courts. We're going to see declines in supervision. These are all things that governments do that we will benefit. We will also see societal benefits. And in the case of criminal justice, what we're talking about here are victims. If we avoid, let's say, sex offender treatment in supervision, which is a proven effective practice, if we're able to administer the service and we avoid sex offenses, we're going to avoid victims. Those are folks that are going to have both tangible and intangible costs. Tangible costs like declines or costs related to hospitalizations or lost wages, and intangible costs related to pain and suffering. So those are the societal benefits. And we break them out separately so that you can see in which category these accrue. Now, for the full inventory, we looked at 71 services. Very positive narrative overall. We see that we're using a lot of evidence-based practices. The Department of Corrections and counties have adopted many of the best practices available. Of the 71 services that we see, 34 of them are promising or proven effective. That's a really great story. But there's still a lot of work to do. That indicates as well that we have more services that we can either evaluate or do a better job of adopting the evidence-based practices that are available, particularly in supervision. Of those 71 services, we looked at 19 specifically for benefit cost analyses, the full analyses. The requirement to do the full benefit cost analyses is that we needed sufficient data. We either needed a well-done local study done by our own Department of Corrections and their excellent research team, or we needed a study that was in our statistical model or a group of studies that were in our statistical model. So at this point, we looked at 19. I mentioned that this is ongoing analysis. In future years, we will add additional services to this list and to the full benefit cost analyses. Of the 19 services that we examined, all of them have positive benefits. That means a benefit cost ratio above zero. Somewhere in here, for each of these 19 services, we are improving the outcomes that we see. 18 of them have benefits that exceed costs. That means a benefit cost ratio of greater than 1. 14 of those are also going to generate taxpayer benefits that exceed a dollar invested. Now, when we talk about benefits, I mentioned this, but we're talking only about the benefits related to declines in recidivism, jails, courts, prison, the intangible benefits and the tangible benefits that are associated with reductions in victimization. We're not monetizing things yet like employment, changes in mental health or health care. We're not monetizing things like institutional safety. As well, the benefit cost analysis is focusing on cost effectiveness. It's a very strong tool for looking at cost effectiveness. It does not, however, include other values that we have that we think are important. Things like justice, equity, innovation are not inside of cost effectiveness. Cost effectiveness cannot speak to those things, the other reasons that we may do services. And so we talk about that a bit in the full report, which you have, but do not include it in the cost effectiveness analysis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. I just had a question for the testifier, or this may be a counter, maybe it'll turn into a question. Your presentation says report does monetize benefits. I just want to make sure the note should have a nod in there.
And besides
pointing that out just for the future as you're doing it, what feels especially important about that is if we're talking about taxpayer benefits, and I understand why that'd be excluded, but employment, of course, there's going to be like direct taxpayer benefits coming out of that. So I do want to make sure just to note to add the knot in there, but also that's probably going to be a lot of taxpayer benefit coming from people who have actual jobs and are paying taxes from those jobs, in addition to all the other benefits. So I guess that's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merrick, do you want to wish to continue?
Yes. Thanks, Chair. And thank you, Representative Pinto, for that comment. We do talk a little bit where research is available about the impacts of employment. There are some well-done local studies that speak to that employment impact, and we include that in the broader context of the report. At the present time, our model doesn't allow us to monetize employment, but we think in the future it will, and in which case where research is available and research speaks to it, we hope to include those employment benefits and potentially other benefits. In our mental health report, which is we also received in December, we were able to monetize those employment impacts. And yes, that is supposed to say does not monetize. Thank you very much. So I'm going to just quickly walk through one example and allow time for questions. Overall in supervision, we see benefit cost ratios, and this is page 2 of the 4-pager. We see benefit cost ratios that range from $11.40 to $1.80. In prison, in the institutional side, which is page 3, we see ratios that range from $15.90 to 40 cents for a dollar invested. Some of these services as well, you'll see this at the top of table 1 on page 2, electronic monitoring and probation. Some of these services both reduce recidivism, the research tells us, and also is less expensive than the alternative service. In this case, we were unable to do a benefit-cost ratio because, if you think about it, benefits on top, costs on the bottom, we have a negative number in the bottom, and therefore we can't actually infer a benefit-cost ratio. We get both benefits from doing something that's cheaper and also benefits from reduction in recidivism. For electronic monitoring, the alternative is jail often, and so putting someone on electronic monitoring is cheaper than having someone in jail and thus the lack of benefit-cost ratio. Walking through one example of a full benefit cost ratio, if we look at on the first page, we can look at intensive supervision, surveillance, and treatment. These are more intensive services that we offer for individuals with a higher risk. They involve higher caseloads for probation officers, and they also include requirements of getting some treatment complete. For each investment we make this, make an intensive supervision, if we deliver it correctly, we see a benefit minus cost in the over that five-year period of $13,460. That means the total benefits minus the cost of actually doing it net us $13,000 on average. The benefit cost ratio we see is $3.80. It's broken into taxpayer benefits, $1.20, and other societal benefits, which is $2.60. This is available for all of the services. The full report also gives profiles on each service to talk in greater depth about each one. I won't go into each service listed on here just for time's sake. The final thing I want to talk about are some other key considerations that we see as we did this analysis. You know, we spent a very long time speaking to practitioners and providers. We spoke to counties and caseworkers. We spoke to probation officers and individuals that administer supervised release. We spoke to police and sheriffs. And there were a lot of pieces of information that came to the top that were really important context to add that we tried to supplement the broader report with. The first is in the inventory, you'll see a lot of services that are theory-based. Of the 71 services, there are 23 that are theory-based that we could not say the outcome yet on recidivism. There's an opportunity there to explore those services, to conduct evaluations, to make sure that we are getting the outcomes that we deserve and that we expect. Number two, implementation is important. If we do not deliver the services with fidelity or deliver them according to the research model, we may not get the returns that we anticipate. We won't see the same returns on investment, the benefit-cost ratios that we see here, if we do not implement these services correctly. The report highlights some times that we may have challenges with that. One of them that it highlights is that we have really high caseloads right now, generally, in supervision. And if we are going to deliver something like supervision with risk-need responsivity principles, we need to make sure that our caseloads are aligned with national standards, or else we may not get the benefit-cost ratio that we would expect. The third point is that we have this decentralized model, which is great because it allows for a lot of innovation and a lot of local context and a lot of ability to talk about local need. It also means that there are a lot of differences between counties and their adoption of evidence-based practices, their use, their investment. And so we do see differences between the counties that we looked at, and we talk a bit more about that in the full report. I'm going to go ahead and end there and allow time for questions.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've several times now heard and seen data in this committee about the increased prison population related to domestic violence offenders, particularly the changes over the last, over a decade with the enhancement. So we're talking repeat offenders. But when I'm looking at the service industry inventory for prisons, and I realize it says it's for major services and treatments, I'm not seeing better intervention listed or anything specific to domestic violence. Can you just clarify whether I'm missing that or if that's not considered a major service?
Yeah, so we haven't explored that. Yes, thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you, Representative. We haven't explored that in the prison context yet. We do include it in the supervision inventory, and it is listed in the supervision inventory under batters intervention. And it is a little bit of an interesting case, and I'll bring it up just because I think that there may be questions. So we have two batters intervention, the supervision inventory, which is the orange document. The first is batters intervention, just treatment. The second is batters intervention with a coordinated community response. This is we bring in a lot of different services to help both the individual receiving treatment and potentially their spouse receive services. There's a community of practice that goes around making sure that folks are staying in treatment and we're getting positive outcomes and we're not getting repeat offenses. The first is the batters intervention treatment. This is an interesting case. The research, actually, there's a lot of research on the effectiveness of this treatment, but the research was inconclusive. We had many studies that we looked at. In some cases, we saw improvement related to recidivism, so declines in recidivism, declines in domestic abuse. And in some cases, we saw no effect related to those services. And even one or two studies, we saw increases in recidivism. So we listed it as research inconclusive. The second line down, though, is coordinated response, which is listed as theory-based. Right now, given a system of coordinated response included with the treatment, we don't actually have any evaluations that meet our criteria in that place yet. So we do not have a way to say there's a causal relationship between that service and declines in recidivism. But the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women has provided some evidence, some high-quality evidence, albeit not of that treatment and control group style that is in the Voices from the Field.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you. And I, while I appreciate its inclusion in the supervision and the discussion and acknowledgement of the coalition's research they've provided, it's been my experience that globally, in this committee, even outside of this committee, a lot of words are spoken about domestic violence, but we don't necessarily put the resources to actually do anything about it. And so it's concerning to me that that's not better intervention programming within the prison system is not considered a major service. I mean, it looks like we have some programs for women offenders who have been victims in this Beyond Violence and Beyond Trauma programming, which is great, but I'm not seeing a direct directly addressing the offenders themselves.
Mr. Merritt.
Thank you, Vice Chair. These inventories we consider living documents, and so we'll work on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might not be a question for you, but maybe Commissioner Roy. The Affordable Homes Program, are the inmates paid when they do that?
Commissioner Roy, could you possibly come down and answer that?
Sorry.
Chair, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections, Representative Considine. Yes, and I will have to get you the details on that. But this relates to one of the benefits that Mr. Merrick was talking about, that especially related to recidivism. What that particular program does, obviously, is builds the resume of those offenders who can apply for work and say, yes, I know how to use a tape measure and a radial arm saw, and that might be the changing element in their life.
Representative Constantine, any follow-up?
Follow-up, and then I got another question, too. Ran a similar program to this in Blue Earth County, but it was strictly voluntary, and frankly was amazed at the pride that the offenders took in volunteering their time. For some, it was the first time they had ever done something for somebody else, and I would argue that in that case it had an effect on recidivism because they took pride and bought into the community. And I don't know if that's a possibility with you guys or not, but in fact, I used to go get some big fights with probation officers, and some of your folks, they would want to know the hours so they could give them credit for community service, and absolutely not. You don't get anything for this. This is a restorative justice program. You're giving back to the community, and like I said, I had amazing results in the pride that they took. And like I said, I would argue that at that point that it would have impacted recidivism. So, next question, though, is back to this young man.
Thank you, Mr. Go ahead, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really bothered by the correctional adult basic education where it says no effect on recidivism. Mm-hmm. I go up to the Bridge program. You have a theory. It requires a high school diploma or GED to participate. Career and technical education, proven effective. The requirement requires a high school diploma or a GED to participate. There are two more on the back that are proven, the Employ program and the MnCorp program. Each one has that as a requirement, and you have to get into it. So how does the not have any impact on recidivism work with the basic education system?
Mr. Merrick?
Hi, Chair, Representative. Thank you so much for that question. And first of all, I want to say that is exactly how you're supposed to read this document, looking at that Voices from the Field column and pulling in those pieces. We really appreciate that you pointing that out. The adult basic education services, the research tells us that there's no statistically significant impact on recidivism. Now, however, it is a requirement to have a GED to get into some services that do have a statistically significant impact on recidivism. Services like career and technical education, services like you mentioned, MnCorp, we see proven effective impacts on recidivism for these services. Now, the research itself tells us, though, that having that adult basic education, that GED is a component, but is not going to be the factor that has that impact on recidivism. We do not see a statistically significant result just with a GED alone. It is a component towards a greater goal.
Okay, I guess I would argue that without the GED, then you're not eligible. And
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I also agree with that, but sometimes they might be incarcerated long enough to get their GED, but not go in the other programs. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
I'm very glad to look at all these reports after we spent so many months kind of preparing to look at them. So, you know, I'm a proponent for the specialty courts or treatment courts or whatever word we're using now. We seem to keep changing the words, but the DUI courts at W or the drug courts, mental health courts, veterans courts specifically were analyzed. And most of them say promising, with veterans saying still theory. Is that really because they're so new? It's something that's fairly new in the whole field, and maybe there just isn't enough analysis to do, or is there more going on?
Mr. Merrick.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I'm not exactly sure. I can't say exactly for sure, but that would be my suspicion. It does take a bit of time to evaluate these services. You know, we need to have a couple of years of data of them in operation. So that is the reason right now it's promising. My guess is that there are additional pieces of research out there right now working to evaluate those services.
Representative O'Neill, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that they're very new in Minnesota, and they're very new across the nation, and so I'm looking forward to seeing. I know most of this is done in about a five-year increment. They're looking at recidivism over a five-year period, and a lot of them haven't been around here in Minnesota for 5 years. Some have, but not all of them, particularly Veterans Courts is particularly new. So I hope that we do this again and we can analyze that and take a look, because it's very intense and it's very individually focused, which is helpful for folks to change their lives. So thanks. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Merrick, I want to thank you for being here and presenting this. A lot of good information. I'm looking forward to reading through this. Members, we have a session in 15 minutes. So with that, we will be adjourned.
Thank you, committee.